David Crow. Thank you for tuning into episode 230 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen Tuesdays at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on prn.fm or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or other programs. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. PRN.FM also has voicemail. Call 862-800-6805. And as well as leaving a message or question for the show, leave your name and indicate that the question is for The Infectious Myth. If you dial either of these numbers, long-distance charges may apply. I don't know that you're a listener until I hear from you, so send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and what you like about it. If you include your mailing address, I'll send you a little thank you gift, one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. I do really love to hear from my listeners, so don't be shy. You can make a one-time donation to the expenses of the show via PayPal using the email david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, or you can commit to monthly donations at patreon.com or liberapay.com, where we are also Infectious Myth, one word. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want the show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you're gleaning, for the support you get for some of your non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of, on any topic that you think I have an interesting and worthwhile opinion on, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending the show to your friends. Tom wrote to me via email, "I have a question about your episode on measles. I really appreciated how thorough it was. At one point you suggested that measles could be vitamin A deficiency, and you also brought up that getting measles once is supposed to give a person lifetime immunity. Can you get lifelong immunity to a vitamin deficiency? I never heard that having scurvy once prevents future episodes of it. Just curious if lifelong immunity might indicate that it's not a vitamin deficiency." So I wrote back to Tom, "Thanks for your positive feedback, and your question is very good and something that I've wrestled with. I think the answer is that there are a lot of assumptions made and many reasons for rash and fever. For example, the CDC famously gave a photo of a vaccine adverse reaction to CNN as an example of natural measles. It turned out that it came from a CDC database of photos that clearly state it was a smallpox vaccine reaction. Recently, I asked my mother if she remembered how she diagnosed me with measles versus, say, German measles, rubella, versus chickenpox. Because back then, hardly anybody went to the doctor for these conditions, so diagnosis was largely by mothers. She said that measles was going around. In other words, if the radio was reporting an epidemic or other mothers, she would have used that information. And you'd already had the other two, so she made a diagnosis using the assumption that all these diseases could only be acquired once. Now, what would have happened if I'd had spots and a fever after having the other three illnesses? She probably would have said it's something you ate. Or given that my mother was more environmentally aware than most, perhaps they sprayed the school with insecticide, which they did frequently back then. The reality is that very, very few measles cases were diagnosed with virus tests. Most were diagnosed clinically, using the same logic as my mother used, i.e. clinical symptoms plus a knowledge of previous illnesses. It would have been fun to go to one doctor and have a child diagnosed, telling them that the child had previously had rubella and chickenpox, and to another doctor with the same child saying that the child had had measles and rubella. Virus tests are expensive, slow, and require taking blood, so would have been rarely done, especially because people didn't go to the doctor in most cases. I think the historic number of measles cases must have been estimates because the vast majority of people didn't believe that you needed to go to a doctor for these childhood illnesses unless the fever or other symptoms got out of control. So I don't have a firm answer, unfortunately, because nobody was asking the right questions in the 1950s and 1960s. And now let's go to this week's interview. I introduced Paul Kinnett and Bob Dixon in episode 222. I didn't expect to have them back so soon. Paul, if as you probably remember, is the founder and former head of the Fluoride Action Network, a chemist by profession. Bob Dixon is a Calgary-based MD who founded Safe Water Calgary to oppose the reintroduction of water fluoridation in Calgary. When I said goodbye to these two gentlemen at the end of episode 222, Calgary was about to have a city council meeting that was expected to recommend the reintroduction of water fluoridation. Conant and other opponents were promising a response to the so-called Cadeth report. The University of Calgary O'Brien Institute was expected to produce another report supporting fluoridation. Well, things did not go exactly as planned. To recap, Calgary is a city of over 1 million people, so it's important because of its size. That's a lot of people who are either going to be fluoridated or not. If it was in the US, it'd be the 10th biggest city, a little smaller than Dallas, but larger than San Jose. For this discussion, it's important also because it's gone back and forth on the fluoride issue, and whether it stays in the unfluoridated camp or rejoins the fluoridated camp makes a big difference to the future of water fluoridation. We'll discuss what actually happened now. Welcome back to the show, Paul and Bob.
Thank you, David.
Okay, it's good to have you with me. Let's talk about the mysteriously canceled committee meeting. There was a city council, City of Calgary council meeting that was planned. I forget the name of the subcommittee, and it was expected or anticipated that it could recommend refluoridating the water. So what were some of the things that happened that may have caused this cancellation?
Well, when we talked to you, David, it was after Bob and Maria and I had an interview with Dr. Garley of the O'Brien Institute and another member of the committee that was reviewing fluoridation, the safety and effectiveness of fluoridation. And we came out of that meeting with a huge question mark over our heads. I had been able to give, they were very patient with me, I was able to give about a 45-minute PowerPoint presentation on the whole issue of neurotoxicity, going into the history of all the studies, which for me went back to 1996, and particularly focusing on the BASHASH study, which came out in 2017, which showed that exposure to the pregnant mother with fluoride, the higher the dose of fluoride, the level of fluoride in her urine, which is a measure of total dose to the pregnant woman, the lower the IQ of the children. Now, Bob and Maria told me afterwards that they were looking at Dr. Garley very closely, and he was taking very prestigious amount of notes, so was his colleague, and they looked very concerned as I was going through the evidence of fluoride's neurotoxicity and ability to lower IQ of children. Listened very intensely. They were very polite, and we left the meeting whether or not we had been subjected to a feel-good, thank you for coming, you know, the nice, pleasant platitudes, or whether there really had been a rethink. Mm-hmm. But what happened, of course, is the O'Brien Institute came out, and the first words you read are, we cannot say, in the executive summary, we cannot say a yes or no to fluoridation. We cannot say yes or no. That itself was very, very dramatic because we were all expecting them to say yes. The O'Brien Institute has been pro-fluoridation for many, many years. And so that was what was expected, as you said at the beginning. But in the body of this report, there were three pages, pages 19 to 21, they're engraved on my brain, in which Garley, I think, did a very objective review of the neurotoxicity and made it clear that there were solid studies, which indicated a risk, a potential risk to the IQ of children, and that the most sensitive period seems to be during the fetal stage. And what made it even stronger is that Garley actually phoned BASHASH, remember from the 2017.
Is that the Mexico study?
That's the Mexico City study, but okay. It's done largely by North American, Canadian and American researchers, mm-hmm. And a team led by Howard Hugh from Toronto. And then he phoned up Christine Teal, who is the lead author of the study which has just appeared. And he was convinced, talking to them, that there was really solid science behind the notion that fluoride was neurotoxic. He was also very clear in the meeting that he was trying to, if you like, psychologically analyze us Were we the nincompoops, the Flat Earth Society people that he's heard about for years that oppose fluoridation? Was there something mentally wrong with us that we are opposing this important public health practice of fluoridation of the water? And I think it was clear that he came to the conclusion that we weren't crazy, that what we were offering was solid science. And I, to his enormous credit, and I've said this to him in person, and I've said it in public, I've said it to the global TV people, but they never broadcast my interview, how impressed I was with the integrity of this man to actually do what he did for the O'Brien Institute. And that is why, to answer your question, that is why this meeting was postponed. The people promoting fluoridation in the Calgary Council were expecting to come through with O'Brien's endorsement of fluoridation. They didn't. Instead, they had this serious warning about neurotoxicity, and they decided to run for cover and delay the meeting.
Okay, well, let's get Bob's perspective on this. Bob, you're on the ground here in Calgary, so what can you add to Paul's discussion?
I think Paul's analysis is pretty accurate overall. We've been gaining momentum here in Calgary. We're organizing on the grassroots level and at several different levels with a community campaign and also communicating with our city councilors on a regular basis. But the interactions we had with the O'Brien Institute, and particularly with Dr. Galley, were certainly quite profound and ended up, as Paul said, with a something that's never happened in the fluoridation world to my memory, and that's that a major organization has come out with actually warnings and cautions and have not hit the delete button with these new studies coming out. So it did take the people on council by surprise, Diane Carly Urquhart in particular, who's the chair of the Standing Policy Committee on Community and Protective Services, the group in the city that's hearing this report, and we'll be putting on the public hearing that was scheduled for July 24th. So yes, they definitely saw that we had the advantage, we had the momentum, and plus at that same time, there was a confluence of factors. The council was having to cut $60 million from the budget with an additional $70 million to come later in the year. And so they were extremely busy with that. And also the city administration had actually given them a bit of a roundhouse as well, and saying that the administration didn't really feel there was any new money for any new projects at this time. And that's, of course, partly because they were cutting police, fire, and all kinds of social services. And so to have $6 million extra out of nowhere to pay for the infrastructure for water fluoridation, the administration was not in favor of that.
Yes. And the O'Brien Institute, according to Paul, was aware of the upcoming Green study, which was published on August 19th in JAMA Pediatrics. But I am not sure that City Council was aware. So if the O'Brien report was a bit of a left hook, then when the Green study came out, that must have been a bit of a right hook, which must have really put them off balance, because it's pretty strong. And it also got a lot of press coverage, which is maybe unusual for a study that provides evidence against water fluoridation.
I wouldn't be surprised if the Calgarians for Kids Health, Julia Guichon and that group, also knew about the study coming up, because I think there's still a lot of communication between that group and the O'Brien Institute. So they probably at least had some sort of inkling that it was coming out, that there's something major coming out in August. And so that, coupled with, of course, the studies previously and the economics of it all, they thought best just to regroup. And so the hearing probably will not be until about late October, we're expecting.
Right. And Paul, have you heard of any other pending studies that get into the mix?
Yes, I have heard, and I don't want to jinx them by giving any details, save to say that I think there's a study in the works which is going to be even stronger than the green study, or have even greater impact. I can't say more than that.
And is it in the domain of neurology?
Oh, yes, it's in the same area.
Okay, because, I mean, there's other issues like thyroid function and kidney and stuff like that, but it seems right now that the focus is on these IQ studies indicating some kind of neurological deficit with exposure to fluoride. So maybe you can help me understand a little bit the green study. So I got a quote here, which I think is from the abstract. So what it says is that mean urinary fluoride, which they call MUFSG, I'm not exactly sure what the acronym stands for, mean urinary fluoride concentration was significantly higher among 141 women who lived in communities with fluoridated drinking water, and they give an average of 0.69 milligrams per liter, compared with 228 women who lived in communities without fluoridated drinking water, and they had an average of 0.4. So that's a 0.29 difference. So adjusting for covariates, et cetera, a significant interaction between child sex and mean urinary fluoride indicated that an increase of 1 milligram per liter was associated with a 4.49 lower FSIQ score for boys, but for girls it wasn't significant. So if I do the math, because it's less than a 1 milligram per liter difference, am I right in saying that's approximately a 2.6 IQ point drop found amongst those with fluoride?
I think it might be closer to 1.5 if you do the thorough arithmetic. If you look at the range of the urinary fluoride levels, that the IQ difference is about 1.5. But I stand to be corrected on that. But the important thing to remember here is that the US EPA considers a population drop of one IQ point, a substance that caused a population drop of one IQ point, would be a serious health endpoint. So it's only one IQ point. And the reason for this is that we're not looking at an impact on a specific individual. We're looking at an impact on a population. And so what you're looking at is the devastating effect of shifting the whole IQ curve over by a small amount. And whilst that doesn't make a huge difference necessarily on the average person, on the two tails of this distribution, the fraction of children that are above 130, which puts them in the very bright or even genius class, and the fraction which is mentally handicapped with an IQ less of 70, that fraction, that area under the curve of that curve, is shifted over and has a dramatic effect on the number of children. It decreases dramatically the number of children that are very bright and increases dramatically the number of children who are mentally handicapped. Just a small shift.
Right. I want to run a different idea past you. Like that, what you say makes sense, but the assumption seems to be that everybody's equally affected. What would happen if, say, only 10% of boys were affected by fluoride? That would mean if it's a 1.5 IQ drop over, on average, that would be a 15-point drop in 10% of children. And that would obviously be actually a much more serious problem.
Maybe.
We don't know, right? But that's a possibility that it's that there are certain children who are more sensitive. And in those children, there's a large IQ drop. And in most children, maybe it doesn't have any significant impact.
Look, I think at this point, David, the key thing is we must switch to the other scale pan here. We're talking risk benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And in this particular case, it's rather easy because there is zero benefit to the fetus. There's zero benefit on any for any health tissue of fluoride, including teeth. I mean, the fetus doesn't even have teeth, and even the teeth are not growing. The bones supporting the teeth are not growing in the fetus.
Right.
So we have zero benefit, and we have the potential of lowering the intelligence of the population by some amount.
Right.
And we can let the experts argue about some amount, but for the average person and for the decision maker, The answer is clear. We should stop this practice. We know that you're exposing the whole population to A, a toxic substance, and B, a neurotoxic substance. And you can only do harm. And it, regardless of how many people that you harm, you cannot justify in medical ethics, and Bob's, right. Bob's a doctor, you can't justify harming some people supposedly to benefit others. But when there is zero benefit, at least what Christine Teal said, the lead author of the study, is pregnant women should be advised not to drink, to limit their exposure to fluoride. At the very least, warnings should go out to pregnant women. Don't drink fluoridated water. Possibly don't use fluoridated toothpaste. That's an absolute minimum. But yeah. I would go further and say this is a clear indication that we need a moratorium on fluoridation. People say, well, we need more studies. Fine. Have as many studies as you want after you've placed the moratorium. Once you've stopped this immediate risk to the fetus, the upcoming generation, once you've stopped that risk, then you can continue to do studies. You can do studies in areas with natural fluoride. No problem. You can continue doing studies. But what you've got to do right now is there's solid science which indicates that you should stop.
Right. I guess my point is that if the damage, if the neurological damage is evenly distributed, it's a problem, because as you say, you've got a one IQ point drop, you're changing the tails of the normal distribution, so you're going to end up with more children in the disabled, significantly more children in the disabled end, and significantly less in the genius end. But my point is that if it's not evenly distributed, the problem's even worse. Because although you can say, well, 9 out of 10 weren't harmed at all, you now have 1 out of 10 who's seriously disabled. And as we know with things like autism, if you have 1 out of 100 children with autism, you know, that is a huge problem. It's maybe worse than if you had a neurological deficit evenly spread amongst the population. But that's just thought.
I think you're right, and maybe another way of saying the same thing, is that there are children already who are less fortunate than others. There are children who are no fault of their own. Maybe they're exposed to other toxins like lead. Maybe they come from a low-income family. The diet is worse. Mm-hmm. These children, it's going to be made worse for them.
Right. I mean, I think it would be unreasonable to assume that every child's going to be affected in exactly the same way. And I think that was the argument that the mainstream press was making, is like, if you put two people beside each other who have a one IQ point difference, you would not be able to tell the difference.
No.
And that's true. But that doesn't mean that shifting the IQ is not a problem. It's making the assumption that it's evenly spread. And, you know, your argument, Paul, definitely needs to be taken into account, that, you know, it's the tail ends of the normal distribution on intelligence that are important. Can I move on to maybe a pretty representative article in Globe and Mail, which likes to call itself Canada's national newspaper, a very long-term health correspondent, Andre Picard, wrote an article, and he said a few things. I'd like you to respond to them. You can either respond by responding to the comment or commenting on the comment, if you know what I mean. So the first thing he said in the first sentence was that anti-fluoridation is a conspiracy theory.
Oh, well, that's absolutely ridiculous. You know, it's one thing to have contended with this nonsense years ago, say in the 80s or 90s. But now that we're talking solid science, this is the time that the media should focus on the science and get rid of all the distractive. I would call it, it's almost like Donald Trump distracting people from the real issues. The real issue is that a good study or not? Does it come, is it the only study, or has it come in the context of other studies? And in the case of neurotoxicity, there are literally hundreds of other human and animal studies that have already raised red flags in this area. And in the case of Christine Teal, it's a replication of the Bashash study.
Teal being, which study is Teal?
Teal is the lead author.
Okay, she's the last author on the green study. Okay, I was referring to it as the green study, but people refer to it as the teal study because she's the senior author who goes last on the list of authors.
Yeah, most people would refer to it as the green study. Green is a graduate student who's getting a PhD, I think, with this work, and teal is her thesis, PhD.
Okay, got it. Okay, so another thing that André Picard said, which maybe we don't have to comment on, was that fluoride was mentioned by in the movie Dr. Strangelove by a mad general.
Yeah. Okay. The issue again should be resolved on the science, not on a movie that was made in 1964.
Yes. He also said something interesting. Paul. Pardon me, Bob.
David, we have to remember that André Picard is... I guess you could say right of Attila the Hun as far as fluoridation goes. He's been a long-standing member of the press that's been totally pejorative, very, very debilitating for our movement. He has a national voice, and it's a voice that cannot be responded to. We've tried to respond to him many times, and it's like what Ellen says, they just don't answer our calls.
Yeah, well, we can respond to it here. One of the things he said, which I thought was very interesting, and I didn't misquote this, is that fluoridation has been linked to almost every conceivable disease. I don't think he realized what he'd written. What he was trying to say is, you know, people have said it reduces IQ, people have said it harms the thyroid, people have said it harms the kidney. You know, is there anything that people aren't going to say it does?
Well, first of all, there is a humorous side to this. It's been a standard ploy of pro-fluoridationists for a long time to make the argument, oh, the people say it causes housemaid's knee, nymphomania, AIDS. They run off a list of things. You're making it looking absolutely preposterous. No substance could cause all those problems is the message. However, you have to remember that fluoride strikes at the very heart of biochemistry. It inhibits enzymes. It switches on G proteins. It does so many things. It's incompatible with biochemistry. And when you have something striking at the heart of biology, of biochemistry, it's not surprising that it has impacts in many different tissues. And right. It's true. We've just had a major study from Mount Sinai, which says that giving the evidence that fluoride damages the kidney and the liver. And of course, we've known for years it damages the bone and the teeth.
Right.
And we're looking now at the evidence that it damages the thyroid and it damages the brain. This is consistent, highly consistent, with a very active biological substance, which interferes with basic biochemistry.
Right. I mean, that's an important point. You're not, fluoride is not specific to a particular function. It interferes with a lot of different things. So you would expect it to be linked to almost every conceivable disease. Some maybe in a minor way and some in a more significant way. It was funny, it was sort of humorous that he was using this to dismiss fluoride science, because there's so much evidence in so many different areas, then obviously it's a conspiracy theory.
Well, he wouldn't recognize the evidence, the scientific evidence. He would just he would be assuming that we crazy anti-fluoridation people are making this all up, we're imagining all this. Again, we would expect at this time the press to stick to the literature. What is in the literature? Is it good? Is it bad? Is it consistent? And so on.
Okay, one last thing in the Picard study is he dragged out the 1945 Grand Rapids study, and his assessment of the study was that in Grand Rapids after fluoridation there was a major drop in cavities, but in nearby Muskegon, which did not fluoridate, there was not. So what is the problem with these historical epidemiological studies?
Well, even promoters of fluoridation have admitted that the techniques used in those days, the quality of the science, the quality of the epidemiology was very poor compared to today's standards. And there was a whole book written about the weaknesses of these fluoridation trials in Grand Rapids, Newburgh, New York, Brantford, Ontario. And so a whole book pointing out the weaknesses. But, you know, it's interesting how the methodology of this green teal study was challenged by experts, and yet the standards of epidemiology of these neurotoxicity studies are far superior to the standards of the studies done on dental health. Most of the studies which suggest or have been argued to reduce tooth decay, that fluoride reduces tooth, swallowing fluoride reduces tooth decay, are very weak. They are ecological studies, the lowest of the type of studies, or epidemiological studies, where you're comparing results in one community versus another community, rather than looking at results on an individual basis. Remember, in the Bashash and the Green study, they measured the urinary fluoride levels of all the mothers, an individual number, the level of fluoride in their urine. Uh-huh. And then for the offspring, they measured the IQ of the pair, the offspring of the specific mother. So you had
right.
individual measurements for both exposure and result on the effect. This is far, far superior than anything that's been done to demonstrate that swallowing fluoride lowers tooth decay. And in over 70 years, they've never produced a randomized controlled trial, which is the standard that you use to demonstrate the Food and Drug Administration would require, if you had a drug and you wanted to prove that it was effective, that it reduced cobble wobbles or whatever, you would have to do a randomized clinical trial.
And it wouldn't be that difficult. I mean, you could see something where you'd attach something to somebody's house and it would either fluoridate the water or not, and the person inside the house wouldn't know. You could do a double-blind randomized clinical trial of fluoridation if you wanted to.
Yeah, absolutely. And you do it with bottled water. You could have some bottled water that has a fluoride in it and the bottled water which didn't. So yes, it is possible, but it's never been done. And that is very suspicious. But I'm just saying this to point out the incredible double standard in the experts that were produced to, and I think that was orchestrated, the experts that were produced, particularly by the Science Media Center in the UK, to denigrate this study. I mean, they're obviously very frightened of this study. They know, having told the world for over 70 years that there is absolutely no harm caused by drinking fluoridated water. And here are two US government and Canadian government funded studies which have found harm. And somehow, in order to keep this practice going, they've got to criticize the study or criticize, find something wrong with it.
You said, Fan said two things in a press release, which I thought were interesting. First of all, the Green Teal study was published in a JAMA journal, and the American Medical Association has been in favor of fluoridation. It was also subsidized. It was also paid for by U.S. government money, and the U.S. government has been strongly pro-fluoride. So you have a pro-fluoride funding source, you have a pro-fluoride organization publishing the article, and the science that's allowed to be produced still is against water fluoridation, shows harm.
And what you just said is the reason why this study, before it was published, was vetted much more than a typical study. They were frightened of the ramifications of publishing this study. So they got two statisticians to look at the statistics, from what I can understand, and we went through vetting, and two of the editors actually sat down and did a podcast explaining what a shock this study was, how they believed in fluoridation, that they'd learned about this in medical school. I was shocked to actually listening to them to see how little they had absorbed from all the other studies on neurotoxicity.
Right.
They were at least honest about it. And they came back, and the bottom line was that one of them said, I would not advise my wife or a pregnant woman to drink fluoridated water. If it was my wife, I would not advise her to drink fluoridated water. So I think just with Dr. Ghali and now the editors of the JAMA Pediatrics, we are seeing integrity. We are seeing what we've hoped, what I have hoped for, David, for 23 years. that integrity would somehow emerge on this subject, that we would cut through all this public relations crap that you've talked about, the Dr. Strangelove and so on, and that there would be scientists who would recognize good science when it was put in front of them. And not just good science, but science which indicates that we may be damaging millions of people by this practice, which the rest of the world has shown is totally unnecessary.
Bob, would you like to comment on the Andrew Picard article or the underlying teal green study?
Oh yeah, there's lots of comments we could make there. So Andrew Picard, as you mentioned, is really an outlier there. And one of the things that comes up with him is that he doesn't realize the small percentage of people that are going to be sensitive or allergic to fluoride and fluoridation products. We're looking at anywhere between 1% and maybe as high as 15% of the population. Even if it's only 1% of the population that's extremely sensitive or allergic to fluoride, that's a large, large amount of people that we're harming. And actually not just, minor harms, minor illnesses or diseases. We're talking about major effects on lifestyle. So that sensitivity is a very important thing to take into account.
Well, in a city of a million people like Calgary, something that's affects 1% of the people would affect 10,000 people.
Yeah, our population is closer now to 1.5 million.
Okay, so 15,000 people.
15 and 75,000 people are harmed just by the sensitivities of fluoride. And that's a very large amount of people. I remember way back in the day, 5 or 6 years ago, presenting to Lethbridge City Council, and one of the young medical officers of health was a Native fellow, and he was on record of saying to City Council that sometimes we have to trample on the human rights of people for the good of all. And this coming from a Native person.
That's pretty ironic. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, Bob is absolutely correct on the sensitivity issue, which no government, by the way, no fluoridating government has ever attempted to put on a scientific level by doing double-blind tests. But there is something even more concrete, and that is that we know that some children will be harmed by fluoridation because of the damage to the teeth, the dental fluorosis, which they don't even deny. This is harm. And one of the best articles that came out on this whole review of the green study was done by a journalist in Calgary. Is it Lisa Corbella?
Yes.
Yeah.
Lisa Corbella.
Yeah. Lisa Corbella, an excellent, she's written two excellent op-ed pieces now for the Calgary Herald. And I understand that two of her children had dental fluorosis, and that's what turned her against fluoridation. She was told by the dentist there'd be no harm at all from this practice, and then she sees her children with these dreadful fluorosed teeth. It changed her position. But the most important thing is it changed the position of someone who is obviously very bright and very articulate, and she's written two excellent articles. So the last one is, as I say, one of the best articles. And if people haven't read that yet, I'm sure Bob can tell us exactly how to find it. It is an excellent article.
Okay, well, if we can find the link, I'll put it in the show notes. So to go to the O'Brien report, this is my quick summary of what I saw. And I know that the two of you have gone through it with a fine tooth comb, so you know a lot more. So they said, okay, fluorosis is a problem, but it's largely cosmetic. IQ, well, okay, that's a problem. Elderly cognition, they cited two studies not showing harm and didn't give any caveats, and they showed one study showing harm, and they included caveats about why there's problems with the study. They said there's no thyroid problems of significance, no bone health problems of significance. What they said at the end is they mentioned a program you've mentioned before, Child Smile, which is a Scottish program. So Bob, what was your assessment of the O'Brien Institute report, and were there any surprises apart from the inclusion of reduced IQ as a harm of fluoridation?
Obviously, that was a major surprise to have those pages that Paul quoted earlier, 19 to 21, essentially admitting from a major institution, major pro-fluoride institution in public health, that there is potential harm neurological harm, neurological toxicity. That was huge for us. So that was a surprise. Other things that were not surprised were essentially a regurgitation of the CADTH report. And there was a lot that came out of that. I mean, that's one reason why we're fighting this so voraciously, is that we realized that the CADTH report, very recently published in 800 and some odd pages, which no one on city councils or with decision makers are going to read, it's going to be used as a rubber stamp, as a major push to fluoridate virtually all of Canada. So our goal was to refute CADTH as much as possible, and to put our report to city council, our 27 page report with annotations and scientific citations, that quite nicely refutes the things in CADTH and the things in the O'Brien Institute that they did not touch on, or that they negated or sidelined. So we were not surprised very much. We're maybe a bit disappointed that they didn't go a bit more into thyroid toxicity and bone toxicity, but they didn't even touch on the microbiome, which is going to be very significant. There's going to be more research coming up on that. There's a new microbiome center at the University of Calgary, and I planted a seed there for them to start looking into fluoridation as a major effect on the negative effect on the gut microbiome. So I thought it was a decent report, and not too many surprises in it, except for the good surprise in neurotoxicity.
Yeah, so it was a slight move towards caution about fluoridation as opposed to gung-ho pro-fluoridation. And Paul, you, before we take a couple minutes to talk about your response to the CADTH report, was there anything else about the O'Brien report that surprised you?
Well, I thought they more or less towed the line on most issues, certainly on benefit. In that case, they produce what we expected them to say as pro-fluoridation, hitherto pro-fluoridation, but with this one huge caveat that they sounded the alarm on IQ, on neurotoxicity, and that's all you need. I mean, as far as the counselors are concerned, they have to say, until this issue is resolved, it is unthinkable that we should deliberately go back to adding fluoride to the drinking water. It doesn't matter how good it is for teeth. If we got
Let's say they admitted that, okay, pregnant women shouldn't drink fluoridated water. Would it be practical to have a water fluoridation system where pregnant women were not drinking that water?
So I think it'd be extremely difficult for them to organize. I think certainly if you're a believer, then they should go through the steps of trying to do that. I don't think they would succeed. I don't think they would succeed. You know, there is another double standard here. This whole practice is predicated on the notion that we can't educate parents to educate their children to brush their teeth.
Right.
So if you don't have much confidence in your ability to educate people, how on earth would you be able to educate all the pregnant women in Calgary to change behavior? It would be an extremely difficult thing to do.
No. And you're doing this to supposedly support the poor. So if pregnant women are supposed to buy bottled water and they're of limited income, that expense may be something they'll put aside because they got to pay rent and they've got to get clothes for their children for school and they got other things. It's not going to be at the top of their priorities.
Yeah, that exactly. So any way you look at it, any councillor that votes to add fluoride to Calgary's water right now needs their head examining.
I'll put in a link to your response to the CADTH report because we don't have a lot of time to go through all the details. They addressed the IQ issue and they rated only one study as high quality, which was the Broadbent study. So can you briefly talk about that?
Well, that is incredible. Broadbent is a dentist in New Zealand. He actually appeared on television during one of my tours there. And during my tour, this was a few years ago, probably 2015, and where I had been talking on television about fluoride's neurotoxicity. This is before Bashash. This is based upon the Chinese and Indian studies that were finding lower IQ in fluoridated communities with high fluoride. And he came out with this paper and he said on television, this is one of the strongest studies, blah, blah, blah. And when it came out, I was absolutely astounded. First of all, if you read it, his language is so obviously biased. He attacks the Chinese studies and says how awful this will be for New Zealand if they stop fluoridation, blah, blah, blah. So clearly he had an agenda. It screams at you. And then when you look at the study itself, there were nearly 1,000 of children in the fluoridated, had grown up in fluoridated communities, but less than 100 in the non-fluoridated communities. So there you have such a discrepancy that the study lacks power if you've only got 100 in the control. And then it's well known that in New Zealand in the 70s when this study was started, that children that were in non-fluoridated communities were taking fluoride supplements. The long and short of it is there was practically no difference in the fluoride intake between these two communities. So it's not surprising that at the end of the day, he comes back and says, we couldn't find a difference in IQ between these two communities. It really is a junk science. I'm sorry. And for Kadish to give it a high rating tells you a lot about Kadish.
Okay, well, tell us what you really think about broadband. I guess you did. I don't know. There were also socioeconomic differences between the groups, right? Like the rural areas of New Zealand were not fluoridated and the cities were. So you're really taking two very different, you know, groups of people.
Yeah, absolutely. And another thing, he chastised the Chinese studies by saying they didn't control for different things. Some of them did, actually. But he had data on lead. He had data on manganese and other neurotoxicants in the water supply. And he didn't control for them, even though he had the data in this large Dunedin study. It wasn't his study. He just used the data from a pre-existing study, the Dunedin study.
Right.
The cohort there. So, you know, he couldn't even live up to his own standards of criticizing the Chinese studies for not controlling for lead. He didn't control for lead, even though he had lead data.
I've seen that kind of criticism before where people criticize certain types of study and then they run the studies with the same characteristics and don't criticize themselves. Bob, we don't have time to go through the whole Cadith response, but you know, what were some of the highlights for you in terms of your response to a very mainstream Canadian institutional study saying there's no problems with fluoride, no health problems, and it's effective at reducing cavities?
Yeah, well, I'd advise people to read our report, which is very extensive, which draws on expertise from all around the fluoridated planet. We go through several different categories, and there's big ones in there, like Paul mentioned, the economics of it. Even in Calgary, the economics of the damages caused by fluoride, like if you take the one IQ point, which is very, very conservative, one IQ point drop, for Calgary, we calculated that out to mean it was close to $9 billion cost to Calgary alone over the next 40 years. So, you know, there's things like that we tackle in our report, and I will send you the link to our report so you can post that online with your folks.
Sure. I mean, I think they quoted a $1.2 billion benefit in less cavities. Is that correct?
Yeah, they use that antiquated $38 spent or saved for $1 spent on water fluoridation. That has been debunked by several studies in the past few years. I mean, and they're all over the map with that one. They go anywhere from $16 to $38 to $60 to even $120 was the last one I heard. $120 saved for every dollar spent on water fluoridation. Well, it's absolutely untrue because they don't take into account the cost of treating fluoridation, which can be huge. There's dentists in Calgary that have charged as much as $70,000 a patient to treat severe fluorosis, and you know, that negates a lot of $120 fillings.
Yes, and fluorosis is is seen as a cosmetic problem. I mean, to me, the economics, I mean, if it was expensive and it did exactly what they said, that it reduced cavities and had no health impacts, then okay, we can talk about, you know, whether we can afford it. But to me, the health impacts are outside the realm of economics. I mean, if we're reducing the IQ of some or all children, even just boys, that's a problem. I mean, as males, we know that boys can be pretty dumb at times anyway, so we don't make the problem worse.
Yeah. So we're covering all the bases there. We're covering everything from economics through ethics and morality. And the science, so we've got them on virtually in all those categories and all those things.
And it's not that long, so it's a good read. It's not huge. Paul, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, David. If there's one absolutely simple and fatal flaw of the Kadish report, you better check the date that was published. I think the official date is 2019 for the Kadish report, but. So let's say it's the latest is 2008, the earliest is 2018, maybe. But they didn't cover Bashash. They didn't cover the Bashash study that was published in September of 2017. This was a 12-year study funded by the US government, done by top researchers from Canada, the United States. I mean, it was the groundbreaking, the landmark study on neurotoxicity of fluoride, and they didn't cover it.
Do you think it's possible that they had written this report and they were just waiting for an opportunity to release it?
Quite possibly. But if of course it was published after they had access to Bashash, then you have to be very suspicious about their motivations. If it was published before they had access to Bashash, then clearly this review is completely outdated.
Right. So either way, it's a problem.
And it's very, okay, so David, it's very easy to do an addendum. We did that in our report. If you look at the second or third page of our report, it's a full page of addendums and updates. And we did those within the last few months, not years.
Yes. Okay, well, in the last couple of minutes, perhaps you can each take a minute to just add whatever you think is important, where we're going to go in the future with this.
I think a very important thing to add that we haven't really touched on, and it goes right back to the early studies in the 1940s, and it goes to right through the Kadish report to the present day, is that the pro-fluoridationists always use percentages. And they say, oh, a 20%, a 25% decrease in cavities and caries, or 40, sometimes even a 60% decrease in cavities and caries. If you look at the absolute reduction in cavities and caries, those percentages equate to usually between 1/4, 1/2, as high as one cavity or tooth saved in a lifetime. And those absolute numbers are compared to the mounting evidence with neurotoxicity, thyroid toxicity, and all the other damages, they're almost meaningless. But yet they continue to use percentages because it sounds so much more impactful, so much more prescient, that they can say, oh yes, this large percentage reduction in cavities. We cannot let them get away with that any further.
Paul, famous last words.
Last words are, the cat is out of the bag on the neurotoxicity studies. I've followed this issue for 23 years. I've seen the evidence mount and mount and mount. Hitherto, the problem has been the press, the media have ignored these studies. And the media and the academia have been frightened of getting involved in this kind of research because they are attacked. But now we see that some of the most important people in neurotoxicity, Philip Grandjean, expert on mercury, Bruce Lamphere, the go-to person from public health on lead, Bellinger, the same, a pioneer in lead's neurotoxicity, Howard Hugh, Christine Till, these are the leading figures in the science of neurotoxicity in the world. These people are involved. I believe we'll see more and more research and more damning research, particularly on fluoride's neurotoxicity. And to repeat what I've said before, any counselor that gives the go-ahead to fluoridation today needs their head examining.
One last comment, David. I think what you're seeing now, finally, we've been negated so long for so many decades for any press or publications or acknowledgments or recognition. They've had their fingers in their ears. They've had the blinders on so tightly. They've got their fingers on the delete button. And now the dam is finally breaking. And you see this in this latest report in Till's study. Worldwide now, there's comment after comment, after article, after interview. There's just so much. The dam is starting to break. And now they'll finally start to hear that there are thousands of studies out there anti-fluoride.
Well, thank you, Bob and Paul, for joining me again today. And I don't think we really know what the future brings. So there could be further surprises down the road, and we may have to come back to this issue again in a few months. But thanks for a very important update. I appreciate the input from both of you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, David, for the work you do.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye now.
Hardy Lineback is the former head of preventive dentistry at the University of Toronto, a one-time advocate of fluoridation who changed his mind quite a few years ago. Although he declined to be interviewed, he provided some data. For example, he estimated that based on studies of lead poisoning, which before lead was removed from paint and automobile fuels, was a big problem in the United States and other countries. He estimates that fluoridation could shift the U.S. population from 6 million gifted people and 6 million with special needs to only 2.6 million gifted people and 9.4 million with special needs. He also cited an article from Business Insider that showed that a one-point increase in IQ in a population correlates with a $229 to $468 increase in per capita GDP. I asked him what he thought were the most serious adverse effects of fluoridation, and he provided information supporting neurological effects from prenatal exposure is particularly bad, endocrine effects, i.e. the hormone system, bone cancer risk in boys, bone damage in elderly people, such as increased hip fracture risk. Regarding effectiveness at preventing cavities, he says, there isn't a single randomized double-blind clinical trial to show fluoridation effectiveness. I've proposed two simple studies, but after 75 years of fluoridation, there have been no studies to try and provide definitive proof that fluoridation works. All fluoridation studies are non-randomized, non-blinded, and none of them adjust for all potential confounders that affect dental decay. The most rigorous cross-sectional studies show a savings of maybe one tooth from dental decay per person for 20 to 40 years of fluoridation, representing an insignificant cost savings. In fact, if one calculates how much it costs to treat the 10% of children who would get objectionable dental fluorosis from fluoridation, the treatment of dental fluorosis costs more than the treatment of any fillings that would have been placed if fluoridation was not implemented. Fluoridation, therefore, does not save families money. Thank you for listening to episode 230 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount to Infectious Myth, one word, on patreon.com or liberapay.com. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.